I saw what happened in Baltimore, and of course the narrative that was created around it. I think, but for the grace of God, that could have happened in Portland at any time. And it's been because of leaders that have been working on this issue for a long time, I think, that we haven't had an urban explosion, rebellion, uprising, whatever you want to call it. But not because people aren't just absolutely frustrated that the outcomes, and you clearly talk like an academic, right? Because you talk about the inputs and outputs and and the matrix and that stuff. But I understand what you're talking about in the words that I use would be the outcomes, right? You say this is your vision of what you want, and then at the end of the day, you do an evaluation. And if the outcomes are radically different than what you said your vision was, then either your vision's wrong or the outcomes are wrong, right? And one of those have to fundamentally change. And I think that's where we are in Portland. So I hope that we will have the opportunity as we move forward to really implement some of your components. But as you mentioned, more importantly, is to make sure that it really is a Portland answer to a Portland problem that we can then have ownership of and leadership of.
Yeah, what I want to do is hand you the toolbox.
Right.
That's it.
Right.
You know, it's your house to construct, and I think you guys will be perfectly fine doing it no matter where you want to go. Mm-hmm. The first group that does it is really going to change the history of America going forward. I don't think that any city is going to turn it down once it's done.
Yeah, we got a lot of work to do. Michael, it has been such a pleasure talking to you. So thank you for sharing your vision with us, and best of luck in your studies.
Thank you, Joanne. I greatly appreciate you guys having me here. And if anyone wants to reach out, I'll answer questions as best as I can. It's on Twitter's the easiest way to get a hold of me. Okay. It's at Michael A. Wood Jr. There is no S, but I'm overcorrecting people about that because I've been called Woods pretty much my entire life. Oh, yeah. So maybe I should just change it and get on the same page with everybody else.
Wonderful. So that is your Twitter handle again?
At Michael A. Wood Jr., just the JR. And for website-wise, I'm the CEO and president of Veteran Stand, a nonprofit group giving veterans the platform to have their voices heard and fight community issues like this in their own hometowns. I would rather empower some veterans, people here to stand up to fight than I would be to do it for them.
Well, I just want you to know I'm a vet as well. So I appreciate your work and hope you have a very great day.
Good morning, it's 9:02. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up, Press Watch. Teresa Mitchell brings you the news you're not supposed to know.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of monopoly, media manipulation, and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. According to local news sources, the fire on the radioactive grass of the Hanford Nuclear Reservation is 85% contained. It had spread to 35 square miles. There are other smaller wildfires burning today in the Columbia Gorge and in eastern Washington state. The U.S. corporate press is ignoring consistent pleas from the Chinese government to consider a peace deal with North Korea. The deal is simple. North Korea will cease nuclear testing and missile launches in exchange for the retraction of the massive multi-billion-dollar war games that the U.S. stages twice per year with South Korea. The war games practice assassination and nuclear war scenarios and have forced North Korea into a war footing for decades now. Despite the clear opportunity for de-escalation and peace, the Trump administration yesterday used its UN ambassador Nikki Haley to threaten war. Quoting the Washington Post, President Trump warned Thursday that he is considering some pretty severe things in response to what he called very, very bad behavior from the North, though he did not mention any specific plans. Something will have to be done about it, he said in a speech in Warsaw at an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council on Wednesday. U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley accused China and Russia of holding the hands of the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Haley chided Beijing and Moscow for not supporting a resolution that would tighten sanctions and hinted that the United States is considering the use of force. One of our capabilities lies with our considerable military forces, Haley said. Her words were met with criticism from Vladimir Safronkov, Russia's deputy ambassador to the United Nations, who called stricter sanctions not acceptable and military action, quote, inadmissible. Quoting The Guardian, National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster appears to have moved in a matter of weeks towards military action. On the 29th of June, following the death of Warren Beer and continued North Korean test activity, McMaster warned, quote, the threat is much more immediate now, and it's so clear that we can't repeat the same approach, failed approach of the past, end quote. The Wall Street Journal editorial board openly urged regime change, writing, only a much tougher strategy aimed at toppling the Kim regime, with or without China's help, has a chance of eliminating a threat that puts millions of Americans' lives at risk. The best option is a comprehensive strategy to change the Kim regime, as former Undersecretary of State Robert Joseph has argued. And in related news, it gets worse, doesn't it? I've got an interview coming up, and I hope that you will stick around. I think this will be very interesting. This will be with Paul Street. In related news, the nuclear-powered Nimitz-class aircraft carrier, the USS Nimitz, the lead ship of her class, has deployed to the Asia-Pacific region. According to the U.S. Navy, the Nimitz strike group consisting of the Arleigh Burke-class guided missile destroyers, USS Howard, Shoup, Pinckney, Kidd, and the Ticonderoga-class guided missile cruiser, USS Princeton, arrived in the U.S. Navy's 7th Fleet of Area of Operations on June 21st. The Nimitz's leading carrier strike group 11, which includes guided missile destroyers, USS Shoup, and the others that I mentioned, and a conglomeration of aircraft squadrons that comprise Carrier Air Wing 11. And the USS Ronald Reagan is also in the vicinity of the Koreas. And both of these are carrier strike groups. In the case of the Ronald Reagan, it is part of Carrier Strike Group 9. So each of them is a flotilla of ships. Yes. And from RT.com, a luxury car blaze broke out at a Porsche center in Eidelstadt, Hamburg, early Thursday morning, with as many as 12 sports cars engulfed in flames in a suspected G20-related arson attack. The fire broke out at 3:55 a.m. local time this morning, with firefighters called to the scene at Holsteiner Chaussee shortly after, where they found at least 10 of the luxury cars on fire. A spokesman said 38 firefighters worked to extinguish the blaze, which they were able to bring under control before it spread to more of the luxury sports cars. 10 cars were completely destroyed, while others were damaged by the fire, as well as the foam used to extinguish the flames. Porsche estimated the damage cost more than $1 million. Local officials suspect the fire could be linked to the G20 summit. Police said they are concerned the incident could be an incendiary arson and are looking into whether the fire was related to the G20 summit. As many as 100,000 protesters are expected in Hamburg during the meeting of 20 nations on Friday and Saturday, according to the local newspaper Handelsblatt. And Donald Trump has spent more than 20% of his presidency at golf resorts. This according to Callie Holloway on Alternet. This past weekend was no exception. She writes, after 3 days of hitting balls around it at his club in Bedminster, New Jersey, the president finally decided to return to Washington, D.C. on Monday of this week. Footage of Trump's arrival shows him exiting Air Force One, then descending the stairs of the tarmac where a limousine festooned with American flag awaits. But instead of climbing inside, Trump wanders off in a different direction, taking several steps off course before a Secret Service agent can corral him. It's an odd moment in which Trump briefly appears befuddled and out of sorts. And Callie Holloway's article on Alternet, she goes on to list and to provide videos of the president's confusion, which has fueled further speculation about his possible cognitive decline. The question is whether he is sundowning, whether his brain gets too tired after a certain time in the afternoon. The list is, first, he wandered off in the middle of a foreign press event. Second, he forgot to sign an executive order at an executive order signing press event. Third, he didn't realize Rudy Giuliani was sitting directly in front of him. And fourth, he couldn't correctly name the country he'd just bombed, this over a period of a couple of weeks. So you can find more on that article at alternet.org. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. Today, I'm going to be speaking with Paul Street, author of 7 books and also an urban social policy researcher and teacher in Chicago. He writes regularly for Z Magazine, Counterpunch, and Black Commentator. And I recently read his article in Counterpunch, Beyond Inauthentic Opposition, in which he describes and decries the state of the Democratic Party and the implications of its total submission to corporate capital. He has written one article more recently as well on American Revolution, as it's called, and this being the Independence Day week, I thought it would be timely to talk about that as well. Paul Street, welcome to KBOO and to Press Watch.
Thank you.
Greetings. Yeah. I'm glad that you could make it on the air. Want to ask you about corporate rule in the Democratic Party. Ralph Nader recently commented that the Dems embraced corporatism fervently in the Bill Clinton years and are now hopelessly hooked. So I want to ask you, why do so many U.S. citizens think the Democrats represent them, or do they just hope that they someday will in view of the gleeful corporate bootlicking of the Republicans?
Well, I want to open with a statement of solidarity with the people who are burning luxury cars in Hamburg or wherever that was. I'm sort of joking, but not completely. The latest Oxfam report shows, I think, that we're down now to 5 people who own as much wealth as the bottom 50% of humanity. So there is a problem. Something's wrong with people who drive around in luxury cars, you know. Plus, it's kind of a job creation program for firefighters over there. You can do that. You know, I guess Ralph Nader did say that. I didn't see that myself. He said that the Dems embraced corporatism in the Bill Clinton years, and they most certainly did with NAFTA and, you know, the repeal of Glass-Steagall and deregulation of financial derivatives and all kinds of other wonderful things that happened under the Clintons, which helped set the stage for the total meltdown of the global economy many years later. Though I always got from Ralph, from Nader, and particularly from his book, Crashing the Party, which came out, I don't know, about a decade ago or so, that he really thought that the Democratic Party had turned to corporatism and to corporate rule, at least in the Carter years. And that's sort of all over that book, and that's over a lot of the literature about what happened to the Democratic Party, a lot of movement towards deregulation and neoliberalism and sort of the corporate takeover during the Carter years. I think even historically going further back, the Democrats were always sort of kind of a corporate party, a corporate liberal party in the mid-20th century up through the 1960s and 70s.
And it's kind of hard to pick a particular point. I mean, you tend to go all the way back to the expulsion of the Moors.
Yeah, you can go back to that if you want. But, you know, in terms of why you say U.S. citizens think the Democrats represent them, you know, I don't know that they do. I don't know that Americans actually think that. I mean, the Democrats right now have an unfavorable rating of 60% in the country. The Republicans have an unfavorable rate of 61%. I mean, you know, this is not a party that is held in high esteem and viewed as, neither of them are, neither of the duopoly are. viewed as parties that particularly represent them. I mean, polling data in this country has shown forever that a supermajority of Americans think that big business runs the show completely in government, pretty much regardless of which of the two dominant parties are in control. Polling data in this country forever has said that two parties are not enough. They are inadequate. That the spectrum is too narrow to adequately represent public opinion, in this country. So I'm not sure that most, U.S. citizens do think that the Democrats represent them. Insofar as it's true that a considerable portion of the population thinks that, that Ralph Nader's corporate Democratic Party represents them. Well, I think that's called the manipulation of populism by elitism. I think both of the parties practice that manipulation. I think that's sort of, in many ways, the essence of American politics. And if you want to talk about going back in history, that really has sort of been the essence of American politics, the manipulation of pretending to be a party of the people. That's a tendency in American politics that I would date at least to the Andrew Jackson era. It goes back to the 19th century. I think the Democrats are a little bit better at it, maybe considerably better at that manipulation than the Republicans are.
And yet, from the stats that you mentioned,
for various historical reasons, yeah.
And yet, from the stats that you mentioned, obviously people are at some level onto the game.
Yeah, yeah, and they're better at it. I think the Democrats are at that pose, as a party of the people, and sort of part of their rhetoric going back to their one-time base, which they don't really have anymore, in the working class, and in folks employed in manufacturing. It's interesting. The Democrats are sort of actually better at posing as the party of the people and as the sort of the progressive alternative as the so-called opposition when they're out of office, and they have this, I'm a leftist, I come from a Marxist background. I'm like Eugene Debs. I've always said these two parties are two wings of the same bird of corporate and imperial prey. That's not identical. They're different, but they're two wings of the same bird of prey. They have different histories, they have different constituencies, they have somewhat different funding bases. But they're both capitalist parties. The Democrats are better at pretending to be the opposition party. And I have this strange reason for preferring them to be in office, which is I think they are more easily exposed as a corporate party, when they actually hold the reins of nominal power, right? I mean, it's just a great lesson for young people when Clinton is in there and Obama or Obama is in there.
Hope for change.
And everything, right, and everything still sucks. I mean, this great lesson that life still sucks in America and big business runs everything and that we're a vicious empire. When Democrats are in office, I think people need to see that, Whereas when the Republicans are in, it sort of feeds this notion that everything that's wrong with the country is that a big, evil, stupid, bumbling, vicious, awful, misogynist, racist Republican, he can be named Ronald Reagan, he can be named George W. Bush, or in sort of the ultimate insane, malignant narcissist, clockwork orangutan, orange-tinted beast, this subhuman monster. Donald Trump is in there, and it just feeds this narrative that's what's wrong with the country. There's a Republican in the White House. It's not that we live under the rule of an unelected dictatorship of money, and a dictatorship of empire that's bipartisan. No, it's there's a big, bad, evil Republican in there, and we got to get him out of there, and that'll fix things, And so progressive movements just get sucked into big, giant get-out-the-vote campaigns, all centered on these narrow-spectrum, major-party, candidate-centered, big money, big media, quadrennial electoral extravaganzas that are sold to us as the sum total of politics, the only politics, that matters. It's all about who's sitting in the White House. The great radical late historian, to wind up my rant here, Howard Zinn used to say, what really matters is who's sitting in the streets, not just who's sitting in the White House. The Democrats are all about keeping people out of the streets. They're the great graveyard of left and social movements, keeping people off the streets, off the shop floors, you know, not sitting in, not sitting down, and just focusing all their energy on voting for a candidate. I was, in a weird way, I prefer to have them in office because they teach a lesson when they're there.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. This is Press Watch, and I'm speaking with Paul Street, author of 7 books, urban social policy researcher and teacher in Chicago.
That's an old bio.
Yeah. All right, then. A former teacher in Chicago, and you mentioned Howard Zinn.
Sure.
And I am always excited to promote A People's History of the United States and Zinn's writings. We used to have Howard Zinn call in whenever we could. He's spoken to many people here at the station, and we miss him.
Oh, yeah.
I wonder if you could talk about People's History of the United States for a moment, because I consider it a pretty... Also, if you can align yourself a little better with the cell tower, we're breaking up part of what you're saying.
Oh, okay. I'll see if I can reposition myself.
It's always a catch-as-catch-can.
Howard Zinn, besides being this wonderful critical thinker, had this just wonderful karma about him. You know, they used to say back in the days of the anti-war movement in Boston in the early 60s, before it was huge, first they'd have Noam Chomsky out to speak to just regale everyone with all the depressing data about all the people we were killing in Southeast Asia, and, you know, and just sort of everyone would shake their heads and roll their eyes and, you know, and ruminate about how terrible it was. And just when Noam had sort of finished the rap about how bad things were, in would come Howard Zinn, you know, with the more hopeful and the positive message, you know, building upon the long record of resistance and rebellion in the United States. And it was sort of always a perfect team. The People's History, I did used to teach American history. I taught American history for years as an adjunct in probably just about every educational institution in the Chicago area. And Zinn's text, while not oftentimes without flaws empirically, I mean, any professional historian could sort of find areas that he'd gotten one or two sort of key things wrong and missed some part of the literature. But it had this positive message of democratic rebellion, and it was the perfect readable text to get students interested. You know, it was the ultimate sort of counter text to sort of the official narrative, and I've never seen a book that's better in terms of getting students and citizens to think critically and read about American history. I think someone's going to have to come along and sort of do an update of the People's History of the United States for the Obama years and beyond.
That makes sense. Pardon me. Well, that's a book that for many years, I'm not sure how it is right now, but for many years, every year it sold a few more copies. And so I'm happy to point to its existence, and you can get it right now in the Portland area. You can get it certainly at the Union bookstore in town. That would be Powell's. It's there. Well, now we've mentioned imperialism, so I want to ask you, why do Americans now accept, this is such a loaded question, right? But why do Americans now accept imperialism as an unquestioned and legitimate policy, aside from the costs? I mean, I wouldn't give a damn about the cost if it were acceptable or necessary or moral. Why does it slide under the moral radar?
Well, I mean, the costs are very real, and I think a lot of us on the so-called hard left, our main issue with the old Bernie Sanders thing was his reluctance to talk about the costs, which are extraordinary. Dr. King talked about this near the end of his life. You can't really talk seriously about advancing social democratic programs in this country and fighting poverty in this country if you don't tackle the Pentagon system, the Pentagon budget, which eats up 55% of discretionary spending.
That's incredible, isn't it?
You know, and accounts for an empire that maintains 1,000 military installations across more than 100 countries in the world. You know, it accounts for half of the world's military.
Absolutely, but you know what I'm saying? It's like if it were right, then I'd say, okay, I will make this sacrifice.
Well, I mean, and there's that whole issue as well, and the millions that are killed, and the awful, terrible reactionary regimes like the Saudi Arabian regime and the Arab Emirates that are sustained with the help of U.S. military system, on top of which it's a gigantic system of wealth transfer to high-tech corporations like Raytheon and Boeing and Lockheed Martin and Rockwell Collins, you know, the whole, you know, fill in the blank. I mean, it's just sort of this guaranteed profit system of taxpayer transfer, you know. So, you know, there's that. Now, you know, why does it fall under the radar? Why do people support it? You know, well, imperialism, I'm not even sure people know what that is anymore. It isn't taught anymore in K-12. If it ever was, I don't know when it was in K-12.
It's the I word.
Education. If you're lucky and you go to a college where there still might be some leftists in a history or a political science, you know, left in a political science or a history or sociology department, you might get a primer on imperialism. That's not particularly likely. Only a third of the United States population goes to college, so if you're going to get a background on it, you've got to get one of those strange, weird high school history or civics teachers, you know, who's looking over his back all the time to see how long he can stay, keep his job, while assigning something like the People's History of the United States by Howard Zinn. Such high school history teachers do exist. I know a few of them, but there's not a lot of them, and they don't last too long. So no one's getting an education on that. They're certainly not getting an education on specifically American imperialism. The notion that we are good and that we are good in the world and just sort of universally benevolent, you know, sort of the homeland and headquarters of freedom and democracy, is just ubiquitous on television and in the movies. And there's this sort of, if you watch the 5:30 news, there's this sort of representation as the rest of the world, as just this sort of big, huge, scary jungle of chaos. It's, you know, sort of pretty much, you know, Lord of the Flies, you know, and then benevolent, well-meaning Uncle Sam and his benevolent hero military is sort of there to help. You know, this is what Noam Chomsky and Herman referred to as the manufacturing of consent in the American media system, right? My only issue with that famous text, you know, which is just sort of a basic primer on how the mainstream media pervades this image of the United States as always good, and the rest of the world, you know, except for our allied regimes, as sort of scary and bad and evil, is that it relies almost completely on the news media, on the New York Times, you know, broadcast television, CBS, and all that, sort of the official public affairs, public commentary type of media. Whereas, you know, in my sense, over years of teaching and talking to young people and just living in the society, is that the manufacturing of consent to empire is probably even more significantly carried out in so-called entertainment media and in Hollywood, in movies like, American Sniper, or even more sort of lighthearted types of movies like, Tango Foxtrot, that had this ridiculous woman from Saturday Night Live, you know, trying to be some sort of humanistic journalist during the occupation of Afghanistan. You know, this image of America as always good is pervasive in sitcom, in Hollywood representations, in sporting events where heroes, so-called military heroes, are just routinely trotted out, oftentimes now not just at the beginning of games, but sort of in the middle of games. You can be in the middle of a hockey game, and there's a timeout, and all of a sudden some veterans are hauled out there, and everyone's supposed to stand up. you know, and the Jets fly over the 50-yard line at the beginning of the football game.
It's beyond acceptance. It's more like worship.
It's absolutely like worship, and a lot of us on the left increasingly just feel like we have to go in and buy a drink, you know, when they're playing the Star Spangled Banner. We don't even sing. They dropped singing Take Me Out to the Ball Game during the seventh inning stretch in baseball games, and now everyone is supposed to sing America the Beautiful. But I think another really key factor is that the direct experience of Empire is gone with the end of the draft. I mean, the American ruling class really learned from the rebellion against the Vietnam War that they would never have a citizen army again. They got rid of the draft. I mean, there were just tens of thousands of young men in this country in the 1960s and early 70s.
And they certainly got rid of the journalism.
But they had a direct experience of what we were doing to this poor peasant nation in Southeast Asia that wanted to have national independence and a social revolution. And they came back jaded and rebellious, and they fragged their troops, they fragged their officers, they rebelled, you know, and they made all kinds of connection between inequality at home and empire abroad. And so they got rid of that. They got rid of a citizen army, and now we just send a certain select number of people recruited from the working class mainly to go serve multiple tours in places like Afghanistan and Iraq and God knows where. And that loss of direct experience, I think, is a big part of the loss of a tangible sense of empire.
We're at the bottom of the hour. You're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. This is Press Watch, and I'm speaking with Paul Street, who has been writing for Counterpunch and other publications. And we are talking about Beyond Authentic Opposition, an article which you can find in Counterpunch and related issues. And on imperialism, I don't know where to start. And I certainly have to agree with your analysis that a great deal of the way we experience it now comes out of the rejiggering of the American psyche after the Vietnam War. I remember that the initial Bush administration was very much concerned with that. I remember Reagan administration attacking that tiny island. What the hell was the name of that island? Grenada.
Apparently,
it was attacked for the sake of propaganda. It was attacked for the sake of making Americans feel good after a truck bomb. Just bizarre when you look at it in detail. And I find that it is very hard to engage Americans